West Bend Mutual versus Federated Mutual. Mr. Lavelle.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Jeff Lavelle of Racine, Wisconsin. I represent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company in this appeal. This appeal is from summary judgment from the Northern District of Indiana, the review, of course, de novo. The issue is an insurance company's duty to defend and the scope of its coverage for a policyholder called MDK, a gasoline retailer in northern Indiana, that faced a class action for toxic tort arising chiefly from benzene and gasoline constituents that migrated from the gasoline station following a leak. West Bend Mutual insured MDK for the period approximately 1995 to 2001. Thereafter, Federated Mutual insured MDK. Despite tenders to several insurance companies, only West Bend Mutual stepped to the fore and defended MDK, expending about $1.1 million in its defense, ultimately securing release for MDK at the price of $4 million.
I've got a potential jurisdictional question before we get further into the merits of the coverage claims, and that is that there was a claim in this case. This was mostly a coverage dispute, a declaratory judgment action for insurance coverage, contribution, indemnification, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or subrogation. But there was a claim against the insured by you, the insurer, West Bend, or one of the insurers, for a declaration that there was no duty, as I understand it, correct? And that was dismissed without prejudice?
The terms of dismissal, I believe, were with prejudice, although I'm not super confident of that. I can tell you when this declaration action was initially filed, the case, the Bowens underlying class action, had not been settled. And there was a coverage issue that related to West Bend Mutual policies that had existed for a couple of years that had what we call colloquially the anti-Kiger exclusion, the exclusion that listed gasoline as a pollutant in its definition of the policy.
Oh, so you had a similar kind of clause?
No, actually, quite different, and we do address that in the brief. West Bend Mutual incorporated in its policy an ISO endorsement that came about from ISO after the Kiger decision. That endorsement changed the definition of pollutant to expressly list gasoline as an exemplar. This is a step that Federated Mutual did not take, but could have taken. Both of these companies use ISO forms in their insurance policy construction and drafting.
Okay,
I feel like I'm drifting. Am I answering
the
question?
Well, right. Just to get to the jurisdictional question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The claim against the insured was dismissed and later settled, as I understand it, what you're saying now. You're telling us that it was subsequently settled, so there's no ongoing claim against the insured?
That is correct.
Okay, but because the dismissal documents in this case do indicate that that claim was dismissed without prejudice, which ordinarily would make this entire disposition not final for our purposes, that is, for purposes of appellate review. I'm sure you're familiar with that line of cases.
Yes.
But you're saying now that there is no claim, you've relinquished any claim against the insured, it's
Absolutely.
Been settled, and so if we had to fix that for purposes of our review, you would enter a with prejudice dismissal.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because at the point of settlement for MDK, all of that issue of our policies that had the anti-Kiger became a moot point.
Okay.
We paid to get complete release and satisfaction for MDK.
So if we were to conclude that that's a potential impediment to appellate jurisdiction, you could fix that in the district court?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. And I'll certainly pay attention to that when I get back to the office. The issues I contemplated addressing with you were chiefly the pollution exclusion I've alluded to already, the question of bodily injury or property damage within the policy period, known loss or loss in progress issue, and whether this claim is a claim in equitable subrogation or contribution. The relief we request here, obviously, is a reversal and remand so that the issue of quantification of damage recovery can be addressed by the trial court. First, as to the issue of bodily injury occurring within the policy period, I would like to highlight for you the record. Mr. Titus, the claims supervisor for Federated Mutual, when he was tendered the complaint in this action, asked by MDK to defend it, he reviewed it and hand-wrote on the margins of the complaint in or during Fed policy. This is found at Record Document 180, Exhibit 1, page 11. This was, we submit an acknowledgement by Mr. Titus that indeed there's bodily injury occurring within the Federated Mutual policy period that began in October of 2001. Specifically, he wrote next to paragraph 57 of the complaint that admission, and at paragraph 57, the plaintiffs had alleged that in September of 2002, plaintiffs found benzene in their home, learned it posed a cancer risk, all leading to emotional distress that they alleged later in the complaint. This was referred to and thought of as a fear of cancer case in most respects, and this all occurred, this fear could only have occurred after the Federated Mutual policy period began, because none of these class action plaintiffs appreciated that they had any increased cancer risk until September of 2002. The complaint in the Bowens action also alleged at paragraph 44 through 47 that in the eyes of ITEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, vapor intrusion of benzene into the home was only a mere possibility in January of 2002, but this hypothetical became a reality in August of 2002 when the benzene was then confirmed in the homes as a result of air sampling that occurred there. This is alleged in paragraph 46 through 47. No injury to the body of any plaintiff was alleged in this pleading prior to that date and time. All of this date and time occurs within the Federated Mutual policy period. As the case progressed, mediation occurred, and West Bend Mutual wrote, actually I wrote, to Federated Mutual a March 2007 letter supplying Federated Mutual with additional investigative materials, most notably the plaintiff's expert report, Dr. Karamita, who had concluded, and this is found in our appendix, in Y, particularly pages 11, 12, and page 55, that free product, gasoline floating on the groundwater, had actually been found in 1999 and had migrated into the neighborhood through 2003, and that based on air samples taken in 2002, again, the Federated Mutual policy period, that this injury to the plaintiffs had occurred. Moving then to the second issue I highlighted for you, the pollution exclusion. Federated Mutual employed a different kind of pollution exclusion than did West Bend Mutual. It's found at, the form number is CGF53, and this pollution exclusion reads in its prefatory material and its following subparts much like the standard pollution exclusion that was addressed in Kiger and in Friedline by the Indiana Supreme Court. The preface to the exclusion requires a release or escape of pollutants, and the policy defines pollutants. And in that prefatory language and its definition, this exclusion mimics precisely the Kiger exclusion that was found ambiguous and unenforceable in Indiana.
The difference is that the pollution exclusion in Federated's policy specifically refers to motor fuels.
It does. In subpart F, at the very bottom of this endorsement, there is a reference to at or from a tank that was used for storage of motor fuels, and then it defines motor fuels. But the exclusion is written in outline form so that one only gets to sub F after one gets through the prefatory paragraph 1. And the prefatory paragraph 1 says exclusively pollutants escaping.
Right. That's not how we read insurance policies. There's always subclauses and subparts and little Romanet this and little Romanet that and so forth. We have to read it in its totality.
Yes, so reading it in its totality is difficult. But if the insurer does, as instructed by the policy, go to the definition section, which is the instruction for quoted material, in the preface in sub 1, it says in quotes, pollutants. And so if one were reading it precisely as instructed by the policy, one would then go to the definition of pollutants, see the definition is precisely that definition found in Firm and Kiger, and then perhaps if you're a gasoline retailer, read no further because you know pollutants is not encompassing this gasoline product that is your principal product for sale.
Well, but that interpretation reads out the specific language that includes motor fuels and then defines those to mean petroleum or petroleum-based substances, which is plainly in the endorsement. We can't read that out by virtue of the more general description in the or definition in the body of the policy for pollutants.
Well, I'm not suggesting you read it out. What I'm suggesting is if you look at the definition of pollutant and then you continue reading the exclusion, assume for a moment you're a gasoline retailer who knows of Kiger, and you read the pollutant there and you read the definition and you see that all you have for definition is the same that was in Kiger, and then you continue on reading all the subsections A through F and you get to escaping from a tank, and then you see the motor fuels definition, I submit that's ambiguous because the very beginning of that exclusion tells you the pollutant doesn't encompass gasoline, but at the very end of the exclusion, you're given at least a hint that maybe it does because it defines motor fuels and it talks about motor fuels escaping from a tank.
Well, that's a bit of an overstatement. The generic definition of pollutants in the body of the policy doesn't exclude gasoline. It doesn't expressly include it, but it doesn't exclude it. I guess your argument is based on Kiger, which says that you've got to be explicit if you're selling a gas station insurance policy and you want to exclude coverage for gasoline leaks. That's the import of that case, but it seems to me they were explicit in the endorsement because they included motor fuels and then defined those to mean petroleum.
Well, if
so
I could assume
how is this not then valid under Kiger, which says if it's explicit, we'll enforce it?
Because Kiger goes a little bit forward, is a little bit more forward-looking and explicit than just saying be explicit. At the very beginning of the Kiger decision, the Indiana Supreme Court says the issue presented to us is whether the failure to list gasoline as a pollutant in the definition is fatal to this exclusion. That's how they frame the issue at the beginning. And then we know that Indiana law focuses on the definition because 6 years after Kiger, the Indiana Supreme Court issued Friedline, a pollution exclusion case that concerned carpet glue. And the insured there sought coverage. The insurer said carpet glue is an excluded pollutant. And the court said, relying on Kiger, carpet glue is not listed in the definition as a pollutant, and therefore applying Kiger, and there's even some suggestion that they found bound by it, that applying Kiger, we can't find that that exclusion is enforceable here because it fails to list carpet glue as a pollutant. That's the law in the state of Indiana, and it's not a one-case unsettled proposition, but rather Kiger's a 96 case, Friedline's a 2002 case. This is a fairly well-established position in Indiana law, and while it may seem a little pedantic to demand insurers include gasoline in their definition, that's precisely what West Bend Mutual did. This is a part of the record. This definition amendment that was adopted by West Bend Mutual in its policy and is a part of the record here shows a definition that says including gasoline. So there is the easily available alternative, and I'm looking for the record site here. It's record document 180, exhibit 21. There was a readily available option for an insurer who wanted to follow Kiger. And this endorsement is entitled Indiana Changes. There's nothing ambiguous about what it was focused on. It was intended to address Kiger, and Federated chose not to use it. I do have a longer list, but I also see my white light is on.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowell.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel Chuck Spivak on behalf of Federated Mutual Insurance Company. Your Honors, the majority of the discussion in this case centers on the pollution exclusion, and I'm going to get to that. But at the beginning of Mr. Lovell's argument, he made a big point to talk about how Federated's claims adjuster had made a note in the margin of the complaint indicating that perhaps the claims asserted in that complaint involved damages that may have incurred during the Federated policy. And I would suggest to the Court that that's irrelevant to the legal issues that are presented to this Court for de novo review. For there are two alternative grounds that the District Court did not address that would also result in a finding of no coverage. This Court is certainly entitled to and can, under the law, consider those alternative grounds, too, beyond the pollution exclusion. And those are the Federated specific endorsement for continuous injury or damage, which very specifically says that even if damage occurs during the policy period, this policy will not cover it if that loss or damage is deemed to occur prior to the policy period. And note the use of the word or there. The words of construction require policy language to be given its standard and ordinary meaning. That's not a rule against the application of proper grammar. And the leading expert on the interpretation of this type of language, Professor Gardner, says the word or means either or both. And in this case, the record is absolutely undisputed that there was property damage that occurred prior to this policy period. And we believe the record's undisputed that these claimants were claiming bodily injury prior to this policy period as well. It's also irrelevant for the application of Indiana's known loss doctrine under the Indiana Supreme Court decision in General Housewares. Whether there was damage occurring during the policy period makes no difference as to whether that damage was known to the policyholder prior to the inception of Federated's coverage. And it need not be that the policyholder know the full extent of the loss that it's going to face in order for the known loss doctrine to apply. And in this case, the record is undisputed that this policyholder knew it had a problem as early as 1996. It really knew a problem as early as 1998. It had a monitoring well right in the middle of the neighborhood where these plaintiffs lived, saying that the level of contaminants right at this monitoring well for toluene, benzene, ethyl benzene, exceeded IDEM's maximum standards for public safety. All of this was known before the inception of Federated's policy. And as to this argument that the plaintiffs didn't really know what the extent of their injury was until September of 2002 when they filed their complaint, you've got to take a look at that complaint. One of the big elements of the plaintiff's claim against MDK is that MDK had all of this knowledge and hid it, failed to disclose it, so that they could not then determine the full extent of their injuries any earlier than what they did. Your Honor's insurance insures against fortuities, losses that cannot be controlled at the whim of the policyholder. And if the position in this case is that bodily injury didn't happen legally until the Federated policy period, because the plaintiffs didn't know the extent of their bodily injury until the Federated policy period, because they were deprived of the ability to know earlier because of the whim and caprice of the policyholder in failing to disclose the information it had at its disposal, then this is the antithesis of insurance. In this case, the policyholder is completely controlling the risk of loss, and that should not result in the application of coverage under the Federated policy. So with that background as to these two alternative grounds upon which a finding of new coverage can be sustained, let's talk about the pollution exclusion. The fundamental flaw in West Bend's argument is that the Indiana Supreme Court has never said that the definition of pollutants is the only way an insurer can inform its insured that its liability policy will not cover environmental losses arising from a major component of its business operations. Now, there's no question that the Indiana Supreme Court will require an insurer to clearly inform its insured that its policy will exclude the major source of its potential environmental liability. And it said that in Kiger. It repeated that in Seymour. It said it in the summary affirmance in Friedline. And the Indiana Court of Appeals, in a very recently decided case, the National Union versus Standard Fusi case, decided on December 3rd of 2009, and we just got the Westlaw citation. It's 2009-440-3233. Reiterate that standard, but none of these cases say that the only way you can do it is the manner in which you define pollutant. In fact, to say that makes very little sense. It would be somewhat nonsensical for the Indiana Supreme Court to say that the reason gas station owners may not understand that their policies exclude gasoline pollution is because they don't appreciate that gasoline is a pollutant. In fact, let's hope for the sake of the citizens of the state of Indiana that gas station owners understand that gasoline is a pollutant, that it's harmful to human health, it's an irritant, and that it's a contaminant to the environment. In fact, the Indiana Supreme Court acknowledges that in common parlance, gasoline is considered a pollutant, and in fact can't help itself but describe it as such because it uses the word contamination, a derivation of the definition of pollutant contained in the policy, contaminant, five times in its Kiger's opinion in describing the claim for which coverage is sought. If gasoline weren't a pollutant, then there would be no need to clean it up after it had been released, and there would be no grounds for plaintiffs to sue for their injuries after having been exposed to it. In fact, I would dare say we wouldn't be here today if gasoline wasn't an irritant or contaminant, because there would have been no basis for the underlying claim for which coverage is sought. So, of course, gas station owners don't need to be told gasoline is or isn't a pollutant. They're the very people that the law challenges with the responsibility for its safe handling, storage, and transport. So the gatekeeper here, the key, isn't the definition of pollutant, because it's nonsensical to say that a gas station owner will be confused as to the application of its insurance policy because unless explicitly told, it doesn't understand that gasoline is a pollutant. The key, according to Kiger, Seymour, and Friedline, is that a gas station owner's insurer, if it's going to exclude coverage for gasoline pollution, it has to do so more clearly than in the standard ISO policy form. And, Your Honors, the federated policy does that very clearly. In fact, I would submit better than just putting the word gasoline in the definition of pollutants. The federated policy forms, both by the Indiana Changes endorsement and by the pollution exclusion itself, does two things. It tells the gasoline retailer that the pollution exclusion will apply even when the irritant or contaminant is what the insured is in the business of selling, eliminating any concern on the policyholder's part that, yeah, you know, I understand gasoline is a pollutant, but, you know, this is my business. This is what I do. You know, this is what I sell. The policy doesn't tell me that, you know, gasoline, I understand it's a pollutant, but why should it apply because this is my business? The Indiana Change endorsement very specifically says that. And in addition, the language of the pollution exclusion, as Your Honor pointed out in your questions of counsel, specifically tells the gasoline retailer that the exclusion applies to a release that occurs during the precise activities that comprise a retail gasoline operation, the storage pending sale of motor fuels in an underground storage tank. Now, I challenge this court to read the language of that pollution exclusion and come to a conclusion that is that which is advocated by West Bend, that someone could reasonably interpret a policy that excludes coverage for the release of pollutants from a tank that contains motor fuels as being arguably applicable to a release from that motor fuel tank of something other than the motor fuels themselves. It's a logical impossibility. So,
I think,
Your Honors,
counsel, the harder question for you is whether you're on the hook on your umbrella policies on the basis of the products completed operation hazard coverage, which
actually
doesn't have to do with pollution exclusions, et cetera.
I'll move on to that right away because I think I've sort of beaten up on the pollution exclusion enough for the purposes of the argument. Your Honor, the umbrella policy, that's actually an easier argument. The Indiana Supreme Court in the B&R Farms case, which involved a escape of liquid fertilizer from a storage tank in a nearby creek, dealt with the products completed operation standard and held that this applies to the circumstance where a defective product causes harm away from the insured's premises. The products completed ops hazard applies only to claims arising from the placement of defective goods in the stream of commerce.
Right,
now, there's different language.
The business risk policy was phrased differently in that case.
There's different language in that policy. It talks about after physical possession of such products has been released to others, but that's not the basis for the Supreme Court's holding in B&R Farms. That language was in there, according to the court, in order to establish that the putting of the products into the stream of commerce requires a volitional act, not an accident. The holding is predicated upon the policy language as a whole, which is the same as here, containing all the hallmarks of defective product litigation. It talks about warranties regarding fitness, quality, durability, performance. It talks about failure to provide or providing inadequate warnings. All of this stuff has to do with defective products, not with the mere product itself.
The language of the coverage is broader than that.
Your Honor,
just like the language of this exclusion, when it appears in CGL policies as an exclusion, is broader than that. I mean, you can't have it both ways as an insurer.
No, obviously, Your Honor, at the end of the day, if you think it's broader than that, what you say controls. What I would suggest is that it is not broader than that. The language of the policy, when read as a whole, specifically indicates that it's talking about specific, particular products liability cases because it talks about the typical hallmarks of a products liability case. It talks about warranties. It talks about warnings. And don't take my word for it. There are two decisions coming out of the Southern District of Indiana that involve exactly the same policy language as contained in the Federated policy that does not contain the additional language contained in the B&R Farms case, but nevertheless hold that the B&R Farms decision is applicable to our policy.
Is this generally accepted in the insurance industry that these products, completed operations hazards, whether they appear in a CGL policy as an exclusion or whether they appear in as an endorsement for specific coverage for this kind of business risk, either exclusion or coverage, only applies to products liability actions?
Absolutely.
And there's treatise support for that?
There is, Your Honor. I can't recall whether we cite treatises in our brief because we felt that it was sufficient to cite the decision of the Indiana Supreme Court and then two pretty well-written decisions of the Indiana Federal Trial Courts.
Right, because the Indiana Supreme Court didn't cite anything for that conclusion. It just sort of made a bold declaration that these coverages only apply to products liability claims or losses from products liability claims. And ordinarily, you know, from a court of last resort, we'd expect a little bit more support for a sweeping statement like that.
Well, Your Honor, I would say three things. First, I think that it's fairly obvious, again, from the language of the policy language itself, that the manner in which it's written as a whole clearly is connoting an application to defective product claims, not just to the fact that your product happened to have something to do with the loss if there's no defect in it. And there's no contention here that this gasoline was defective or that the environmental contamination occurred because the gasoline is a defective product. I'm sure it was perfectly good gasoline. Had it been in someone's engine as opposed to in the people's backyard, it would have powered the engine just fine. But the language of the policy clearly connotes the idea of a defective product. And while Your Honor appears to be wrestling with this, I would submit that the judges in the Nautilus versus Don Gunn case and the Ohio Casualty versus Reed case, this same policy language, without the language in the B&R Farms case, had really no problem saying B&R Farms doesn't turn just on that policy language. It only applies to defective products cases. And the facts of those cases are illustrative. Don's Guns, gun shop owner, negligently sells a gun to someone who then goes and uses it to try to commit suicide. And there's a suit that's brought against the gun shop owner saying that you negligently sold the gun. And the claim for coverage is, well, your policy says that we'll cover all damage arising out of your product. So this is your product. You sell the gun, and the damage is arising from the claimed suicide. Trial judge in that case, and apparently neither appealed or this court didn't take it. I don't have the history in front of me. Trial court in that case said, look, this policy language only applies to defective products. There's nothing defective about the gun. Unfortunately, the gun worked just fine. This isn't the type of coverage meant to apply to a situation where an otherwise non-defective product just happens to be the instrumentality of the plaintiff's loss. Same with regard to Ohio Casualty, and that was even more on point. That was an accidental chemical contamination case, and the court said Indiana courts will not find accidental chemical contamination cases will fit within the scope of the product's hazard coverage.
And then your known loss doctrine argument applies to the umbrella policies as well as
absolutely,
to the primary policy.
Known loss isn't predicated upon policy language. It's a
common law doctrine.
It's a common law doctrine. Insurance is predicated upon fortuity. Fortuity fails in a situation where the insured is aware of the circumstances of the loss, even if it doesn't know the entirety of the potential claim before the coverage is procured.
Thank you, Mr. Spivak. To the level.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court again. I'll move quickly to the additional liability coverages, as the Court has suggested interest in that area. This additional liability coverage is particularly significant because the amended pollution exclusion doesn't exist in it. It has the Kiger infirm pollution exclusion. The gasoline here was a product that leaked and infiltrated into homes. The plain language of this policy, plain language that Federated Mutual wants to live by on the exclusion for pollution, has to skewer it here, because this plain language in its products completed operations hazard coverage is very different from what was considered in BNR Farm Services.
Do you know what the treatises say about the interpretation of this sort of coverage?
I do not believe there is much treatise on this at all, and I can point, for example, to Don's Guns, which cites just BNR and then a Texas and an Arkansas decision on this issue. There's no treatise citation in there either.
There's a lot of law and treatise treatment of this kind of business risk language in an insurance policy when it appears as an exclusion in a CGL, isn't there?
Yes, and in fact, that's one thing. I see my red light, but one thing I wanted to highlight, that in BNR, it was an exclusion, and different rules of interpretation apply to it. It's to be strictly construed against the insurer, and so I submit the court was straining.
That's fair.
To find coverage, and you should be viewing it in a different way here because of...
Court will proceed.
Yes. Exactly.
Mr. Level, Mr. Spivak, gentlemen, with regard to the jurisdictional inquiry we made, and you were going to check that, Mr. Level?
Yes.
Would you, within 7 days, file
absolutely.
A report on that? And if there's any concern, Mr. Spivak, you...
There's no concern on our part.
I suspect that there wasn't when you didn't raise it. So we would just like to confirm your representation.
Okay. Your Honor, if I could ask, I referenced the decision in the Court of Appeals decided on December 3rd. Would the court appreciate a 28-J submission?
Yes, I would, and, of course, with notification, Mr. Level.
I'll submit that, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both very much.
It's not an exclusion that's at issue here. I see my red light. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks to all counsel. The case.